Disc 13. Another critic, Benjamin Rush of Philadelphia, exhibited the often untutored indignation that greeted Hamilton's plan. Making the exaggerated claim that Congress was now legislating for British subjects, Rush objected not just to public debt, but to all debt as harmful to society. "Let us not overvalue public credit," he warned. "It is to nations what private credit and loan offices are to individuals. It begets debt, extravagance, vice, and bankruptcy. I sicken every time I contemplate the European vices that the Secretary's gambling report will necessarily introduce into our infant republic." Compounding Hamilton's problems was that his report crystallized latent divisions between North and South. There was a popular conception, to Hamilton, a gross misconception, that the original holders of government paper were disproportionately from the South and that the current owners who had swindled them were from the North. Hamilton denied that any such regional transfer took place, contending that the debt was now concentrated in Northern hands only because much of the war had been fought there and more Northern soldiers had received debt certificates. Still, the impression persisted that crooked Northern merchants were hoodwinking virtuous Southern farmers. It didn't help that many New Yorkers in Hamilton's own social circle, James Duane, Governor Morris, William Dewar, Rufus King, had accumulated sizable positions in government debt. Philip Schuyler alone had a $67,000 stake and was reportedly so alarmed by Senate diatribes against Hamilton's plan that his hair stood on end as if the Indians had fired at him. And it didn't seem to occur to Hamilton that legislators, like Caesar's wife, should also be beyond suspicion. From the controversy over his funding scheme, we can date the onset of that abiding rural fear of big city financiers that came to permeate American politics. Hamilton knew that many current creditors who would profit from his measures were less than angelic. His vision, however, was fixed on America's future, not the partisan bickering of the moment. He was laying the groundwork for a great nation. The general rules of property, and all those general rules which form the links of society, frequently involve in their ordinary operation particular hardships and injuries, he told Washington. Yet the public order and the general happiness require a steady conformity to them. It is perhaps always better that partial evils should be submitted to than that principles should be violated. On February 8, 1790, the House of Representatives began to debate Hamilton's report on public credit, which monopolized most of the second session of the first Congress. Maclay's diary tells us that the edgy Hamilton had started lobbying a week earlier, flitting from one member to the next. "Mr. Hamilton is very uneasy, as far as I can learn, about his funding system. He was here early to wait on the Speaker and, I believe, spent most of his time in running from place to place among the members." Many congressmen experienced Hamilton's influence as an unrelenting pressure. To mental vigor, he added organizational bustle. A day after the House debate began, Maclay got a visit from another early Hamilton mentor, the theologian Dr. John Rogers, who expounded Hamilton's system as if he had been in the pulpit. The Society of the Cincinnati is another of Hamilton's machines and the whole city of New York. Before long, the disgruntled Maclay berated Hamilton's tools and gladiators for badgering him without remorse. Americans had rejected a parliamentary system on the British model, forbidding executive officers from sitting in the legislature, but Hamilton's ubiquitous presence in Congress seemed to violate that understanding. In fashioning his program, Hamilton had counted on loyal backing from James Madison, now a Virginia congressman. Ever since his inaugural address, President Washington had consulted regularly with Madison on matters ranging from etiquette to the selection of ambassadors. By dint of his seminal role at the Constitutional Convention, his Bill of Rights, and his work on the Federalist Papers, Madison was the most influential congressman. If Hamilton thought Madison would support his plans, he was rudely undeceived on February 11, 1790, when the Virginian made a speech attacking the funding scheme. Madison was prepared to allow current holders of government debt to profit from past appreciation of their government securities. But as to future appreciation resulting from Hamilton's program, he wanted that windfall to go to the original holders, no matter how long ago they had sold off their securities. For Madison, these original holders had not surrendered faith in government, as Hamilton alleged, but had merely sold in desperation. He thought that blameless patriots were being victimized, and it disturbed his sense of justice that speculators were buying up debt from ignorant country folk. Madison saw a betrayal of the American Revolution in the making. Hamilton was flabbergasted. He had laid out all the practical problems that made such discrimination unworkable, especially the missing documents that would be needed to trace original holders. And Madison's proposal would damage the invaluable principle that buyers of securities should reap all future dividends and profits. In Hamilton's view, government interference with this right amounted to confiscation of private property. Madison's arguments had a strong sentimental appeal to patriotic veterans, while Hamilton's contained a core of hard-headed practicality. As the debate dragged on, the Federal Hall galleries filled with speculators wagering on the outcome, and tension built as a vote approached on Madison's proposal. On February 20th, Abigail Adams told her sister that she was to attend the great debate on discrimination. "It is thought that tomorrow will be the decisive day with respect to that question. On this occasion, I am going for the first time to the House." Hamilton had marshaled his forces effectively, whereas Madison had proven clumsy and inflexible. "Madison's pride seems of that kind which repels all communication," a disappointed Maclay wrote on February 22nd. "The obstinacy of this man has ruined the opposition to Hamilton's plan." That day, the House defeated Madison's motion by a 36-13 vote. But in an ominous sign for Hamilton, 9 of the 13 dissenting votes came from Virginia, the most populous state. Madison was beginning to drift away from Hamilton. Although he claimed that he objected only to parts of Hamilton's program, he admitted privately to more fundamental grievances, telling one correspondent, "I go on the principle that a public debt is a public curse." Whereas the Publius team of Hamilton, Madison, and Jay had seen the supreme threat to liberty coming at the state level, Madison now began to direct his criticism at federal power lodged in the capable hands of the Treasury Secretary. John Adams, among others, seemed disillusioned with Madison as a legislator. "Mr. Madison is a studious scholar," the vice president told a friend in April, "but his reputation as a man of abilities is a creature of French puffs. Some of the worst measures, some of the most stupid motions, stand on record to his infamy." For Hamilton, Madison's apostasy was a painful personal betrayal. One of Hamilton's supporters, minister cum speculator Manasseh Cutler, told a friend that Hamilton regarded Madison's opposition to his plan as a perfidious desertion of the principles which Madison was solemnly pledged to defend. This falling out was to be more than personal, for the rift between Hamilton and Madison precipitated the start of the two-party system in America. The funding debate shattered the short-lived political consensus that had ushered in the new government. For the next 5 years, the political spectrum in America was defined by whether people endorsed or opposed Alexander Hamilton's programs. Even as Madison flailed at Hamilton's funding scheme, a seemingly unrelated drama was being enacted in Congress over the slavery issue. Quakers from New York and Pennsylvania had submitted a petition to abolish the slave trade, while the Pennsylvania Society for Promoting the Abolition of Slavery, led by 84-year-old Benjamin Franklin, filed a more aggressive petition to abolish slavery itself. On this sensitive issue, Southern delegates flamed up in righteous anger. Edanus Burke of South Carolina accused the Quakers of blowing the trumpet of sedition and asked that the galleries be cleared of spectators whose ears might be defiled by such heresy. James Jackson of Georgia said that the Bible itself had approved slavery. The vehemence of Southern legislators made plain that on this issue they would brook no compromise. William Lawton Smith of South Carolina reminded fellow legislators that Southern states had ratified the Constitution on the proviso that it would not interfere with slavery. Any attempt to renege on this pledge would threaten the survival of the Union. This fracas was more than a footnote in the country's early history. Slavery was gradually fading away in many parts of the North, but with each passing year it became more deeply embedded in the Southern economy. as Fisher Ames of Massachusetts complained to a friend of Southern indignation. Language low, indecent, and profane has been used. The Southern gentry have been guided by their hot tempers and stubborn prejudices and pride in regard to Southern importance and Negro slavery. The abolitionist petitions were referred to a House committee. When this group reported back in March, it cited the 20-year grace period for the slave trade adopted by the Constitutional Convention, meaning that Congress lacked authority to eliminate the slave trade before 1808, much less to emancipate the slaves. Whether from reluctant pragmatism or outright cowardice, abolition was now officially dead. After the House committee report, Madison, who had just masterminded the Bill of Rights, told Edmund Randolph that the South should bury the slavery issue with benign neglect. The true policy of the Southern members, he wrote approvingly, was to let the affair proceed with as little noise as possible. Madison was torn between intellectual sympathy for abolitionism and fear of irate Southern reactions. Whether or not he was more motivated by a desire to save the Union than to preserve slavery, his views would increasingly be colored by personal and regional self-interest as he curried favor with his Virginia constituents. Tabling the slavery issue had been a precondition of union in 1787, and now again in 1790. Though a passionate slavery critic, Hamilton knew that this inflammatory issue could wreck the Union. He could not be both the supreme nationalist and the supreme abolitionist. He certainly could not push through his controversial funding program if he stirred up the slavery question, which was probably a futile battle anyway. So this man of infinite opinions grew mute on that all-important matter, though he may have taken a secret swipe at slaveholders the following year. Historian Philip Marsh has argued that Hamilton, using the pen name Civis in a newspaper piece of February 23, 1791, penned the following telling sarcasm to Madison and Jefferson. "As to the Negroes, you must be tender upon that subject. Who talk most about liberty and equality? Is it not those who hold the Bill of Rights in one hand and a whip for affrighted slaves in the other?" If Hamilton wrote this, he was updating a jibe by the English radical Thomas Day, who had written in 1776, "If there be an object truly ridiculous in nature, it is an American patriot, signing resolutions of independence with the one hand and with the other, brandishing a whip over his affrighted slaves." The bipartisan decision to shelve the slavery issue had profound repercussions for Hamilton's economic measures, for it spared the Southern economy from criticism. In the 1790s, America's critical energies were trained exclusively on the Northern economy and the financial and manufacturing system devised by Hamilton. This became immediately apparent in the heated debate over his funding system, which allowed Southern slaveholders to proclaim that Northern financiers were the evil ones and that slaveholders were the virtuous populists, upright men of the soil. It was testimony to the political genius of Thomas Jefferson and James Madison that they diverted attention from the grisly realities of Southern slavery by casting a lurid spotlight on Hamilton's system as the paramount embodiment of evil. They inveighed against the concentrated wealth of Northern merchants when Southern slave plantations clearly represented the most heinous form of concentrated wealth. Throughout the 1790s, planters posed as the tribunes of small farmers and denounced the depravity of stocks, bonds, banks, and manufacturing, the whole wicked apparatus of Hamiltonian capitalism. When Congress returned to Hamilton's report on public credit in March, after debating the abolitionist petitions, many Southerners seemed more outraged over the powers that Hamilton planned to give the federal government. If the Treasury Secretary welded the states into a strong union through his assumption plan, might not that strengthen the federal power to meddle with slavery? And did it therefore not behoove the South to resist Hamilton's plan and shore up states' rights? The extent of Southern ire that spring was shown dramatically in the erratic behavior of Edanus Burke. Burke had a shock of thick white hair, a long, pointed nose, and a piercing gaze that expressed his fiery nature. That spring, he found himself in a political bind because he supported Hamilton's assumption program, even though many of his Southern constituents opposed it. To reclaim his political reputation, Burke pounced on a clever diversionary tactic. On March 31st, 1790, he launched a tirade in the House against the July 4th eulogy that Hamilton had pronounced on General Nathanael Greene 9 months earlier. From that speech, he plucked the line in which Hamilton referred to the Southern militia as the mimicry of soldiership. Burke found this reference insulting and countered that many Southern militiamen had sacrificed their lives at the holy altar of liberty. Their graves are to be seen scattered over our glades and woodlands. They are now no more. Then, casting his eyes on the visitors' gallery, since it was packed with pretty ladies, he supposed Hamilton sat among them, he blasted the Treasury Secretary in language that crossed the boundaries of political decorum. In the face of this assembly and in the presence of this gallery, I give the lie to Colonel Hamilton. This blatant affront was so shocking that congressmen interrupted Burke's outburst with loud calls for order. Their main reason for alarm was that Burke, in branding Hamilton a liar, had violated his personal sense of honor. Like many contemporary politicians, Hamilton still inhabited two worlds: the modern world of constitutional law and the old feudal order based on honor and dignity. Unless retracted, any direct challenge to one's honor had to be settled outside the legal realm on the field of honor, the dueling ground. Senator William McClay, who had stopped by the House to eavesdrop on the debate, noted in his diary a violent personal attack on Hamilton by Judge Burke of South Carolina, which the men of the blade say must produce a duel. Some observers did not take seriously Burke's insulting behavior. William Lawton Smith contended that Burke's mode of speaking and his roughness only excite laughter. Hamilton, however, was not laughing. Some members of the legislature did not yet know his irrepressible pugnacity or how fiercely he guarded his reputation. Fisher Ames observed that no man, not the Roman Cato himself, was more inflexible on every point that touched or only seemed to touch integrity and honor than Hamilton. When Smith discussed the imbroglio with him, Hamilton drew a distinction between criticism of his policies and his person. He said he should at all times disregard any observations applied to his public station as Secretary of the Treasury, but that this was not to be passed over. Smith also noted that Burke was amazingly intimate with Governor George Clinton and reportedly courting one of his daughters. Clinton hates Hamilton mortally and has probably set on Burke, he conjectured. The very next day, Hamilton sent off a short, heated letter to Burke. He claimed that the quote from the eulogy had been taken out of context and that the full sentence claimed that General Greene was embarrassed by small fugitive bodies of volunteer militia, the mimicry of soldiership. He had not made a general statement about the South Carolina militia, but only about irregular volunteers. Having thus, sir, stated the matter in its true light, it remains for you to judge what conduct, in consequence of the explanation, will be proper on your part. Before the day was out, Burke replied to Hamilton in a manner that ratcheted up the pressure. In a letter designed for consumption back home, Burke lauded the bravery of the Southern militia. He knew that he had to explain why he had waited 9 months to broadcast his charges. To have done so at the time, he told Hamilton, would have been downright madness, given Hamilton's popularity. In the charged political atmosphere of the moment, the dispute now festered, and factions formed around the principals. "The town is much agitated about a duel between Burke and Hamilton," McClay reported. "So many people concerned in the business may really make the fools fight." A party of six congressmen arbitrated an end to the dispute by securing two letters. One from Hamilton, in which he insisted that he meant no dishonor to the Southern militia, and a second from Burke, in which he accepted this statement and apologized to Hamilton. It was all artfully orchestrated according to the unspoken rules of affairs of honor. The uproar backfired on Burke, who found himself demoted in influence. The affair was not altogether a victory for Hamilton. In his memorial speech for General Greene, he had taken gratuitous swipes at Southern soldiers and had not paid sufficient attention to the pieties of Democratic politics. Burke made him feel the sting of public opinion. It was not the last time Hamilton paid a price for needless indiscretion. The contretemps again demonstrated that beneath his invincible facade, Hamilton was still the hypersensitive boy from the West Indies. His combativeness was always more than just political calculation, for he brooded obsessively about slights to his honor. This supreme rationalist, who feared the passions of the mob more than any other founder, was himself a man of deep and often ungovernable emotions. Chapter 16. Dr. Pangloss. On March 1, 1790, with Hamilton engulfed in conflict over his funding scheme, Thomas Jefferson set out from Monticello to assume his duties as the new Secretary of State. He had sailed from Paris in October 1789, ending a 5-year stint as American minister to France. Only when his ship docked in Norfolk, Virginia, in late November, did he discover Washington's letter asking him to take the cabinet post. The Senate, still in its trusting infancy, had confirmed the nominee before he knew about the offer. Where the hyperthyroid Hamilton jumped at his assignment and sprang quickly into action, Jefferson dithered through the winter about taking the State Department job and did not accept until mid-February 1790. Similarly, as Hamilton, Madison, and Jay had defended the Constitution in the Federalist, Jefferson had vacillated about America's new charter. At moments, he sounded as if he would have preferred a patched-up version of the Articles of Confederation. "There are very good articles in it, and very bad," he declared of the new charter from Paris. "I do not know which predominate." He confided to Madison that he liked the government's division into three branches, but voiced grave doubts about his favorite boogeyman, executive power. In Philadelphia, Hamilton had espoused a lifetime president on good behavior, while Jefferson recoiled at any president who could serve additional 4-year terms. "I own I am not a friend to a very energetic government," he told Madison. "It is always oppressive." Such a man was bound to clash with Hamilton and have misgivings about serving in the new central government. When Congress first met in the spring of 1789, Jefferson was still equivocating about the Constitution. Asked whether he was a Federalist or Anti-Federalist, Jefferson evaded the issue and expressed opposition to all party labels. "Therefore, I protest to you that I am not of the party of the Federalists," he explained to Francis Hopkinson, a Pennsylvania judge and signer of the Declaration of Independence. "But I am much further from that of the Anti-Federalists." So, with a multitude of reservations, Thomas Jefferson cast his lot with the new government. In 1789, French sculptor Jean-Antoine Houdon executed a bust of Jefferson that shows a handsome man with a calm, self-confident air. Yet the vigilant eyes hint at someone who moved slowly, cautiously, taking everything in before acting. The tightly sealed lips convey something enigmatic beneath the patrician ease. Like Burr, Thomas Jefferson found strength in secrecy, in silence. Shy and aloof, he seldom made eye contact with listeners, yet could be a warmly engaging presence among small groups of like-minded intimates. This laconic man knew how to sprinkle his conversation with brilliant aperçu that lingered in people's minds. With his quiet charm and courtly demeanor, he had a knack for winning people over at dinner parties, distinguished by good food and 8 varieties of wine. Tall, lean, and freckled, with reddish hair and hazel eyes, Jefferson had one trait that the marble bust failed to capture: his slack-jointed movements. When William McClay met the new secretary, his slouching figure seemed to lack ministerial dignity. McClay groused, "He sits in a lounging manner, on one hip commonly, and with one of his shoulders elevated much above the other. His whole figure has a loose, shackling air." His dress was casual, almost sloppy. The folksy air charmed people and allowed Jefferson to root out their secrets. The plain dress, mild manners, and unassuming air were the perfect costume for a crafty man intent upon presenting himself as the spokesman for the common people. With an elite pedigree on both sides of his family, Jefferson was anything but common. His father, Peter, was a tobacco planter, a judge of the Court of Chancery, and a member of the Virginia House of Burgesses, while his mother, Jane Randolph, came from a prominent family. By the time Peter Jefferson died, he bequeathed to his children more than 60 slaves, 25 horses, 70 head of cattle, 200 hogs, and 7,500 acres. 2/3 of this bountiful legacy went to his eldest son, Thomas. Peter Jefferson gave the boy a complete classical education. Tutored at home at age 5, Jefferson went to a boarding school at age 9 that afforded such thorough grounding in Greek and Latin that biographer Dumas Malone claims that for Jefferson, the heroes of antiquity were more real than either the Christian saints or modern historical figures. He attended the College of William and Mary, which schooled the scions of the Virginia gentry, before being admitted to the bar. Like Hamilton, Jefferson was a fanatic for self-improvement. He rose before dawn each morning and employed every hour profitably, studying up to 15 hours per day. Extremely systematic in his habits, Jefferson enjoyed retreating into the sheltered tranquility of his books, and the spectrum of his interests was vast. He told his daughter, "It is wonderful how much may be done if we are always doing." Whether riding horseback, playing the violin, designing buildings, or inventing curious gadgets, Thomas Jefferson seemed adept at everything. Like many accomplished people, he was seduced by this quest for self-perfection and not easily lured into public office. The self-sufficiency and philosophic repose made him an atypical politician. He once wrote, "The most effectual means of being secure against pain is to retire within ourselves and to suffice for our own happiness." This pampered life rested on a foundation of slavery. Jefferson's earliest memory was of being carried on a pillow by a slave on horseback. He never tried to justify slavery and said he eagerly awaited the day when an opportunity will be offered to abolish this lamentable evil. When the Virginia legislature rebuffed his bid to stop importing slaves into the state, he regretted that the public mind would not bear the proposition. However much Jefferson deplored the moral and political depravity of slavery, his own slaves remained in bondage to his career and his incorrigibly spendthrift ways. When he commissioned his mountaintop home at Monticello, he seemed oblivious to the toll this would exact on his slaves, who had to hoist the building materials to such a height. In 1769, while the 14-year-old Hamilton dreamed of escape from St. Croix, the 26-year-old Jefferson was elected to Virginia's House of Burgesses. Jefferson belonged to an aristocracy with a clear path of advancement. At 28, he married a young widow, Martha Wales Skelton, who inherited 135 slaves after her father's death. This loving 10-year marriage was marred by childhood mortality. Only 2 of their 6 children reached maturity, and in September 1782, Martha herself died at 34. Only 39 at the time, Jefferson survived his wife by 44 years but never remarried. Ensconced at Monticello with his books, inventions, and experiments, Jefferson became an unfathomable loner. If the American Revolution had not supervened, Thomas Jefferson might well have whiled away his life on the mountaintop, a cultivated planter and philosopher. For Jefferson, the Revolution was an unwelcome distraction from a treasured private life, while for Hamilton it was a fantastic opportunity for escape and advancement. Like Hamilton, Jefferson rose in politics through sheer mastery of words, sunny, optimistic words that captured the hopefulness of a new country. Nobody gave more noble expression to the ideals of individual freedom and dignity, or had a more devout faith in the wisdom of the common man. As chief draftsman of the Declaration of Independence, Jefferson took often commonplace ideas and endowed them with majestic form. When the new government was formed, the Declaration had not yet attained the status of American scripture. Jefferson's authorship remained largely anonymous until he found attribution politically convenient in the 1790s. Thus, when Hamilton first met Jefferson in 1790, he did not see him as quite the revered figure that we do today. Hamilton may have believed that Jefferson's contributions to the nation paled beside his own, and not just because of his own work on behalf of the Constitution. Besides handling Washington's correspondence, Hamilton had spent 5 years in combat, exposing himself to enemy fire on many occasions. Jefferson had never set foot on a battlefield. Elected Virginia governor in 1779, he found the job irksome and wanted to resign, prompting Edmund Pendleton to complain to Madison, "It is a little cowardly to quit our posts in a bustling time." When the turncoat Benedict Arnold burned and pillaged Richmond in January 1781, the capital stood defenseless despite warnings from Washington to Jefferson. Governor Jefferson fled in the early hours, giving up Richmond without a shot and allowing munitions and government records to fall into British hands. In June, in Jefferson's waning hours as governor, the British pounced on Charlottesville and almost captured the Virginia Assembly gathered there. Then, when word came that a British cavalry was approaching Monticello, Jefferson scrambled off on horseback into the woods. He was accused of dereliction of duty and neglecting the transfer of power to his successor. Though the Virginia Assembly exonerated him of any wrongdoing, Hamilton wasn't the only one who suspected Jefferson of cowardice. He later wrote mockingly that when real danger appeared, the governor of the ancient dominion dwindled into the poor, timid philosopher, and instead of rallying his brave countrymen, he fled for safety from a few light horsemen and shamefully abandoned his trust. The Revolution left Jefferson with an implacable aversion to the British, whom he regarded as a race of rich, proud, hectoring, swearing, squabbling, carnivorous animals. He had a long list of personal grievances beyond his distaste for Britain as a corrupt monarchical society. Cornwallis had ravaged one of Jefferson's farms, butchering animals, torching crops, and snatching 30 slaves. Like many Virginia plantation owners, Jefferson was land rich but cash poor and chronically indebted to British creditors. He once said mordantly that the Virginia planters were a species of property annexed to certain mercantile houses in London. By the late 1780s, as tobacco prices plummeted, Virginia planters struggled to repay old debts to London creditors and demanded the return of slaves carried off by British troops. The steep payments he owed British bankers forced Jefferson to retain his enormous workforce of slaves, despite his professed hatred for the institution. "The torment of mind I endure till the moment shall arrive when I shall owe not a shilling on earth is such really as to render life of little value," he told his American manager in 1787. But he would not sell land to pay his debts. "Nor would I willingly sell the slaves as long as there remains any prospect of paying my debts with their labor." The weight of that debt, created by his own extravagance, perhaps prevented Thomas Jefferson from being the person he would ideally like to have been. Even while Secretary of State, he remained in hock to British creditors for an exorbitant £7,000. He carried these large debts until his death in 1826, necessitating the sale of 130 of his slaves at Monticello 6 months later. It was not the image that the philosopher of the common man would have preferred to leave to posterity. When Jefferson went to France in 1784, succeeding Ben Franklin as U.S. minister, the word ambassador was still eschewed as a vestige of monarchy, he had first-hand experience of an absolutist government. The truth of Voltaire's observation offers itself perpetually, that every man here must be either the hammer or the anvil, he told a friend. To George Washington, he expressed himself as unequivocal. "I was much an enemy to monarchy before I came to Europe. I am 10,000 times more so since I have seen what they are." His French sojourn radicalized Jefferson and left him with a heightened suspicion of the damage that could be done by any aristocratic or monarchical sympathies in America, suspicions that were to crystallize around the figure of Alexander Hamilton. All the while, Jefferson clung to a vision of France as America's fraternal ally. "Nothing should be spared on our part to attach this country to us," he wrote to Madison. While scorning French political arrangements, Jefferson adored his life in that decadent society. He relished Paris, the people, wine, women, music, literature, and architecture. And the more rabidly anti-aristocratic he became, the more he was habituated to aristocratic pleasures. Jefferson fancied himself a mere child of nature, a simple, unaffected man, rather than what he really was, a grandee, a gourmet, a hedonist, and a clever, ambitious politician. Even as he deplored the inequities of French society, he occupied the stately Hôtel de Langeac on the Champs-Élysées, constructed for a mistress of one of Louis XV's ministers. Jefferson decorated the mansion with choice neoclassical furniture bought from stylish vendors. The philosopher in powdered hair employed a coachman, a footman, a valet, 7 or 8 domestics in all, a household staff so complete that it included a frotteur, whose job consisted solely of buffing the floors to a high gleam. Jefferson's colossal shopping sprees in Paris. He bought 2,000 books and 63 paintings, betrayed a cavalier disregard for his crushing debts, as well as the slaves whose labor serviced them. While Jefferson's Parisian life seems to contradict his politics, he was embraced by a group of Enlightenment aristocrats who exhibited the same exquisite contradictions. For part of his Parisian stay, Jefferson was joined by his two daughters. The younger one, Polly, arrived in 1787 in the company of his light-skinned 14-year-old slave, Sally Hemings, who was called Dashing Sally at Monticello and was later described by another slave as mighty near white and very handsome, with long straight hair down her back. Jefferson had inherited the Hemings family via his wife, and it is now presumed that Sally Hemings was her half-sister. We do not know for certain whether Jefferson's apparent romance with Sally Hemings began at this time or after he returned to America. He was a widower who was highly susceptible to women. For all his paeans to married life, he had no qualms about flirtations with married women. In 1786, Jefferson, 43, squired around Paris a blonde, coquettish British artist born in Italy, 26-year-old Maria Causeway, whose husband, the painter Richard Causeway, was usually absent. Their dalliance lasted long enough to bring Jefferson into contact with Maria Causeway's closest friend, Angelica Church, who had recently incorporated the Causeways into her thriving salon. When Jefferson first met Church in Paris in late 1787, she acted as a go-between for Mrs. Causeway, which tells us something about her own liberal views on extramarital escapades. "Have you seen yet the lovely Mrs. Church?" Maria Causeway wrote to Jefferson that Christmas. "If I did not love her so much, I should fear her rivalship. But no, I give you free permission to love her with all your heart." Church brought Jefferson a little tea vase from her friend. He was as entranced by the worldly, seductive Church as Hamilton. Jefferson loved her warm vivacity and what he described as her mild and settled temperament. When John Trumbull painted two miniatures of Jefferson, the American minister sent one copy to Maria Causeway, the other to Angelica Church. "The memorial of me which you have from Trumbull is the most worthless part of me," Jefferson confided to Church in an accompanying note. "Could he paint my friendship to you, it would be something out of the common line." In an equally coquettish reply, Church said that she and Causeway were extremely vain of the pleasure of being permitted to write him, and very happy to have some share of his favorable opinion. Though Angelica Church was married with four children, Jefferson persisted in his advances. In 1788, projecting a trip to America the following year, he invited her to visit him at Monticello, or else he would visit her in New York and they would travel to Niagara Falls. So close were Jefferson and Angelica Church at this time that Jefferson's copy of The Federalist displays this surprising dedication: "For Mrs. Church from her sister, Elizabeth Hamilton." Evidently, Church had given Jefferson the copy that Eliza rushed off to her in England. In the end, Angelica Church spurned Jefferson's coy overtures, and nothing ever came of their flirtation. The feud between Hamilton and Jefferson forced Church to choose between the two men, and, inevitably, she chose her brother-in-law. Yet the brief liaison may have had a political impact. During her 1789 stay in New York, Church doubtless told Hamilton about Jefferson's fling with Maria Causeway and his provocative suggestion that he and Church travel together in America. She may even have voiced some suspicions about Sally Hemings, whose son Madison later claimed that it was in Paris that my mother became Mr. Jefferson's concubine, and when he was called home, she was enceinte by him. Any such gossip about Jefferson in Paris would have given Hamilton an image of the new Secretary of State strikingly different from the more ascetic one he wanted to project to the world. And when Hamilton later began a campaign to unmask what he saw as the real Jefferson, the closet sensualist, the knowledge of Jefferson's amorous ways, culled from Church's stories, may have colored his portrait. Both Hamilton and Jefferson came to see each other as hypocritical libertines, and this fed a mutual cynicism. Hamilton offered testimony of his own inexcusable lapses in this area, while the Sphinx-like Jefferson was a man of such unshakable reticence that it took 2 centuries of sedulous detective work to provide partial corroboration of the story of his sexual liaison with Sally Hemings. A congenital optimist, Jefferson was convinced that France, following America's lead, would cast off the shackles of despotism. Lafayette and other French aristocrats, he believed, after imbibing a love of liberty in America, would effect a comparable transformation in their own society. In November 1788, Jefferson wrote to Washington of a France buoyant with hope. "The nation has been awakened by our revolution. They feel their strength. They are enlightened. Their lights are spreading, and they will not retrograde." No less serenely, he told James Monroe that within 2 or 3 years, France would have a tolerably free constitution without having cost them a drop of blood. As late as March 15, 1789, Jefferson seemed oblivious to the violent emotions churning in the breasts of the French populace, telling Madison, "France will be quiet this year, because this year at least is necessary for settling her future constitution." By this point, desperate French peasants were looting grain wagons. The following month, the mere rumor that a wallpaper manufacturer was about to slash wages led workers to encircle his house, shouting, "Death to the rich! Death to the aristocrats!" The subsequent crackdown on protesters left dozens, perhaps hundreds, dead. It would be richly paradoxical that Jefferson, long an eyewitness to French politics, was blind to the murderous drift of events, while Hamilton, who never set foot in Europe, was much more clear-sighted about the French Revolution. At first, Jefferson's exuberance was natural and understandable. In June 1789, the legislature was renamed the National Assembly, as Louis XVI seemed to accept a constitutional monarchy. On July 11th, Lafayette presented to the Assembly a Declaration of Rights that had been helpfully reviewed by Jefferson. Then came the gory atrocities that shadowed the Bastille's fall on July 14th, 1789. Severed heads propped on pikes, mutilated bodies dragged through the streets, corpses swinging from street lamps. For those who cared to read the signs, the future of the revolution was written in these blood-stained images. Simon Schama has noted that violence was, from the outset, part and parcel of the revolution. The notion that between 1789 and 1791, France basked in some sort of liberal pleasure garden before the erection of the guillotine is a complete fantasy. With his highly selective vision, Jefferson preferred to dwell on the hopeful aspects of the situation and filtered out the carnage. On August 3, 1789, he wrote to a friend, "It is impossible to conceive a greater fermentation than has worked in Paris, nor do I believe that so great a fermentation ever produced so little injury in any other people. I have been through it daily, have observed the mobs with my own eyes in order to be satisfied of their objects, and declare to you that I saw so plainly the legitimacy of them that I have slept in my house as quietly through the whole as I ever did in the most peaceable moments. I will agree to be stoned as a false prophet if all does not end well in this country." To Maria Causeway, Jefferson hazarded a small joke about decapitating aristocrats. "The cutting of heads is become so much a la mode that one is apt to feel of a morning whether their own is on their shoulders," and he left little doubt that the French Revolution was a worthy sequel to its American predecessor. "My fortune has been singular to see in the course of 14 years 2 such revolutions as were never seen before." Even as Jefferson departed from France that fall, thousands of poor, desperate women were swarming toward Versailles, determined to drag the royal family back to Paris. Many Americans were flattered to think that their revolution had spawned a European successor with a similar respect for legal forms. All the more prophetic, then, the letter of October 6, 1789, that Hamilton sent to his old friend Lafayette, who had been appointed head of the National Guard. Sitting in New York, slaving over his report on public credit, the new Secretary of the Treasury peered deeper into French affairs than did Jefferson after 5 years in residence. "I have seen with a mixture of pleasure and apprehension the progress of the events which have lately taken place in your country," Hamilton began his carefully worded letter. As a friend to mankind and liberty, I rejoice in the efforts which you are making to establish it. While I fear much for the final success of the attempts, for the fate of those I esteem who are engaged in it. Hamilton knew that Lafayette would wonder why he experienced this foreboding of ill, and listed four reasons. The first three were the disagreements that would surface over the French Constitution, the vehement character of the French people, and the resistance of the nobility to the sacrifices they would have to make. The fourth point was perhaps the most compelling. I dread the reveries of your philosophic politicians who appear in the moment to have great influence, and who, being mere speculatists, may aim at more refinement than suits either with human nature or the composition of your nation. The future Secretary of State, now sailing home, was to strike Hamilton as just such a philosophic politician, ignorant of human nature. Hamilton later explained to a political associate that Jefferson in Paris drank deeply of the French philosophy in religion, in science, in politics. He came from France in the moment of a fermentation which he had had a share in exciting, and in the passions and feelings of which he shared both from temperament and situation. Fresh from the French Revolution, Jefferson was to be greeted by a most unexpected shock when he showed up in New York to assume his post. On March 21, 1790, Jefferson moved into lodgings on Maiden Lane, where he was to live with something less than Republican austerity. From Paris, he had shipped home 86 crates packed with costly French furniture, porcelain and silver, as well as books, paintings, and prints. He had brought home 288 bottles of French wine. To appease his craving for French food, he also brought along one of his slaves, James Hemings, Sally's brother, who had studied fine cooking with a Parisian chef. While Secretary of State, Jefferson maintained a household of five servants, four horses, and a maître d'hôtel imported from Paris. In seeming contradiction to this patrician style, Jefferson cherished a vision of America as a place of Arcadian innocence. "Indeed, madam, I know nothing as charming as our own country," he had written to Angelica Church from Paris. "The learned say it is a new creation, and I believe them, not for their reasons, but because it is made on an improved plan. Europe is a first idea, a crude production, before the master knew his trade, or had made up his mind as to what he wanted." Settled in his palatial Parisian residence, Jefferson lamented reports of unspoiled Americans succumbing to luxurious ways. "I consider the extravagance which has seized them as a more baneful evil than Toryism was during the war," he told one correspondent. Now he was eager to assess the tone of sentiment in America after his prolonged absence. In New York, Jefferson soon decided that America had been corrupted in his absence and that the Revolution stood in mortal danger. He concluded that a preference of kingly over Republican government was evidently the favorite sentiment among affluent New Yorkers. As he attended dinners, he was taken aback by the pro-British inclinations of many merchants and the sumptuous gowns and jewelry of their wives. The town struck him as infested with Tories and avaricious speculators in government securities, all looking worshipfully to Hamilton as their favorite. The heroes of 1776 had given way to those of 1787. As exemplified by Hamilton, they were a different, more conservative breed. Jefferson blamed the influence of British manners and manufactures for this decay of Republican purity. 12 years Jefferson's junior, Hamilton had never met him before. Hamilton had been a lowly artillery captain at the time Jefferson was composing the Declaration of Independence, and Hamilton's incandescent rise had coincided with Jefferson's years abroad. Hamilton would have heard favorable things about Jefferson from Angelica Church and from James Madison, and the latter likely introduced them. That Hamilton and Jefferson were to become antagonists in a bloody, unrelenting feud would not have occurred to either man upon first meeting, and their relations started out amicably enough. Alexander and Eliza hosted a welcoming dinner for the newcomer, who showed up in a blue coat and crimson knee breeches and talked fondly of the French people and their desire to eliminate the monarchy. Jefferson got to know Eliza so well that he chided Angelica Church in June for not writing more often and sighed with mock despair, "I can count only on hearing from you through Mrs. Hamilton." The new Secretaries of State and Treasury traded cordial notes. Jefferson never underestimated Hamilton's superlative talents. After reading The Federalist, Jefferson pronounced it the best commentary on the principles of government which ever was written. Nor did he slight Hamilton's virtues. As he noted in later years, after their epic battles had faded into history, Hamilton was indeed a singular character of acute understanding, disinterested, honest, and honorable in all private transactions, amiable in society, and duly valuing virtue in private life. Yet so bewitched and perverted by the British example as to be under thorough conviction that corruption was essential to the government of a nation. By corruption, Jefferson did not necessarily mean outright payments so much as unhealthy executive influence over legislators through honors, appointments, and other perquisites of office. A central tenet of the American Revolution had been that a corrupt British ministry had suborned Parliament through patronage and pensions and used the resulting excessive influence to tax the colonists and deprive them of their ancient English liberties. Jefferson always viewed Hamilton through the lens of this unsettling analogy. By the time Jefferson arrived in New York, Madison had been trounced by Hamilton in the discrimination vote, and the Treasury Secretary was hurtling ahead with his funding scheme. Jefferson must have regretted having arrived so late. He had no doubt that the original holders of government paper had been cheated of rightful gains by speculators who were fraudulent purchasers of this paper. Immense sums were thus filched from the poor and ignorant, and fortunes accumulated by those who had themselves been poor enough before. Jefferson's objections to Hamilton's plan had philosophical roots. In his view, the smaller the government, the better the chances of preserving liberty. And to the extent that a central government was necessary, he wanted a strong Congress with a weak executive. Most of all, Jefferson wished to preserve state sovereignty against federal infringement. Since Hamilton's agenda was to strengthen the central government, bolster the executive branch at the expense of the legislature, and subordinate the states, it embodied everything Jefferson abhorred. Jefferson feared that the funding scheme would create a fiercely loyal following for Hamilton among those enriched by it. He later told Washington that Hamilton had promoted a regular system of interested persons who were at the beck and call of the Treasury Department. He was convinced that congressmen were investing in government securities, and that even in this, the birth of our government, some members were found sordid enough to bend their duty to their interests and to look after personal rather than public good. Jefferson also did not believe that Hamilton really intended to pay off the government debt. "I would wish the debt paid tomorrow," Jefferson told Washington. "He wishes it never to be paid, but always to be a thing wherewith to corrupt and manage the legislature." This idea of perpetual debt flew in the face of Hamilton's express words and turned his funding program into a blatant grab for power. The ideological differences between Hamilton and Jefferson did not blaze into sudden, open enmity. In their early days in the cabinet, these erudite men held many private talks, with Jefferson hoarding statements by Hamilton that he later used against him. As a courtly gentleman of impeccable manners, Jefferson shrank from disagreement. Unlike Hamilton, a swashbuckler who reveled in debate, Jefferson hated controversy and was more guarded than Hamilton in exposing his thoughts. He suited his words to the occasion and catered to listeners' prejudices, saying what they wanted to hear. This kept his own views secret while encouraging others to speak. Hamilton, opinionated, almost recklessly candid, was incapable of this type of circumspection. Jefferson had learned the advantages of inscrutable silence. While serving with Jefferson in the Continental Congress, recalled John Adams, "I never heard him utter three sentences together." On another occasion, Adams labeled the Virginian a shadow man and likened his character to the great rivers whose bottoms we cannot see and make no noise. For Hamilton, unable to govern his tongue or his pen, his habit of self-exposure eventually placed him at the mercy of the tightly controlled Jefferson. Jefferson's horror over the discrimination defeat led to the first major political alignment in the infant republic as Jefferson made common cause with Madison, now the House floor leader. Their partnership was to have ramifications for America's future as important as the earlier one between Hamilton and Madison. Of the nearly mystic bond between Jefferson and Madison, John Quincy Adams said it was a phenomenon, like the invisible and mysterious movements of the magnet in the physical world. Since Hamilton's relationship with Madison had revolved around ideas, there was little personal chemistry to sustain their friendship when they fell out over politics. Madison's defection was a tremendous blow for Hamilton, who had consulted him in the early stages of his report on public credit. So boundless was Hamilton's respect for Madison that he later said that he would never have accepted the Treasury post had he not believed that he could count on his general support. Jefferson arrived in New York in the thick of the debate raging over assumption, Hamilton's plan to have the federal government assume the $25 million of state debt. This venomous clash made the fight over discrimination look civilized, and Jefferson later categorized it as the most bitter and angry contest ever known in Congress before or since the Union of the States. On February 24, 1790, Hamilton had been stunned when Madison, reversing his former position, contested assumption. Retreating from his old nationalist perspective, Madison complained that his home state and some other southern states had paid off most of their wartime debts and would be penalized if, after having done their duty, they were forced to contribute to those states who have not equally done their duty. To Hamilton, it seemed that Madison spoke for his Virginia constituents and not, as in the Federalist, for the national good. Of course, as Treasury Secretary, Hamilton enjoyed the luxury of a continental view. Hamilton was blindsided by this backlash against his program. That Madison led it was an unkind cut. Hamilton plainly recalled discussing assumption with Madison during an afternoon's walk at the Constitutional Convention, and we were perfectly agreed in the expediency and propriety of such a measure. Madison's physical appearance, his pale, unsmiling visage, his detached air and short stature transmitted a superficial impression of timidity. And some fellow politicians believed that Little Jemmy, as he was known, lacked the commanding, decisive air of a successful politician. Unlike Hamilton, his mental vigor was not matched by a corresponding talent for translating thought into action. His great fault as a politician appears to me a want of decision and a disposition to magnify his adversary's strength, Congressman Edward Livingston told his brother Robert R. Livingston. He never determines to act until he is absolutely forced by the pressure of affairs and then regrets that he has neglected some better opportunity. So powerful was this appearance of timidity that many observers were convinced that Madison, 8 years younger than Jefferson, must have been dominated by his shrewd mentor. Mr. Madison had always entertained an exalted opinion of the talents, knowledge, and virtues of Mr. Jefferson, Hamilton later wrote. But he thought that at bottom each man stiffened the other's determination in opposing his funding program. Jefferson was indiscreetly open in his approbation of Mr. Madison's principles upon his first coming to the seat of government. I say indiscreetly because a gentleman in the administration of one department ought not to have taken sides against another in another department. The impression that Jefferson controlled Madison could be misleading, and not only because Madison deserted Hamilton before Jefferson even arrived in New York. Like Jefferson, Madison operated in the shadows and relied on subtle craft and indirection. His professorial air masked an iron will and a fanatical sense of conviction. Albert Gallatin, later Treasury Secretary under Jefferson and Madison, was to call Madison slow in taking his ground, but firm when the storm rises. If anything, Madison had a more supple and original mind than Jefferson and a deeper grasp of constitutional issues. If Madison in the 1780s was a philosopher king, Madison in the 1790s was a formidable practicing politician and so skillful at cutting deals that he was dubbed the Big Knife. Hamilton's followers, who feared Madison's ability to marshal votes, later called him the General, and Jefferson the Generalissimo. Congressman Zephaniah Swift of Connecticut later confirmed that Madison's lack of Hamiltonian verve could be deceptive. He has no fire, no enthusiasm, no animation, but he has infinite prudence and industry. With the greatest apparent candor, he calculates upon everything with the greatest nicety and precision. He has unquestionably the most personal influence of any man in the House of Representatives. I never knew a man that better understood how to husband a character and make the most of his talents. And he is the most artificial, studied character on earth. On four separate occasions between February and July 1790, the dexterous Madison thwarted attempts to enact assumption. People whispered into Hamilton's ear that Madison was jealous of his power, that Madison coveted his job. Time showed that political differences dwarfed personal considerations. Hamilton's funding plan brought state loyalties to the surface. Some states, such as Massachusetts and South Carolina, struggled with heavy debts and were glad to be relieved by the central government. Others, such as Virginia and North Carolina, had settled most of their debts and saw no reason to help. Such differences threatened to explode the brittle consensus that had been so arduous to reach at the Constitutional Convention. In defending his plan, Hamilton did not just speak in arid technical terms. He talked of justice, equity, patriotism, and national honor. His funding system was premised upon a simple concept, that the debt was generated by the Revolution, that all Americans had benefited equally from that Revolution, and that they should assume collective responsibility for its debt. If state debts were unequal, so were the sacrifices made during the fighting. Praising the immense exertions of indebted Massachusetts, for instance, Hamilton stated, "It would not be too strong to say that they were in a great degree the pivot of the Revolution." Some states, he noted, had paid their debts by ignoble means. New York, for instance, had reneged on interest payments to drive down the market value of its debt, making it cheaper for the state to buy it back. Hamilton also made a subtle, sophisticated argument that without assumption, indebted states would have to raise their taxes, while healthy states would lighten their tax loads. This would trigger a dangerous exodus of people from high-tax to low-tax states, producing a violent dislocation of the population of particular states. For Hamilton, assumption was his make-or-break issue, and the outlook looked grim. Hamilton recalled, "It happened that Mr. Madison and some other distinguished characters of the South started in opposition to the assumption. The high opinion entertained of them made it be taken for granted in that quarter that the opposition would be successful." Hamilton threw himself into battle with his accustomed impetuosity. In this exceptionally hard fight, Hamilton had to lead the charge without Washington. The president supported assumption but did not want to be accused of partisanship and so hesitated to express a public opinion. To aggravate the problem, Washington was laid low in May with an attack of pneumonia so debilitating that, Jefferson said, he was pronounced by two of the three physicians present to be in the act of death. You cannot conceive of the public alarm on this occasion. From May 10th to June 24th, Washington was too feeble to record an entry in his diary, and Hamilton seemed to function as the de facto head of state. In unpublished comments on this period, Hamilton accused Jefferson of harboring presidential wishes during the interregnum. "Mr. Jefferson fears in Mr. Hamilton a formidable rival in the competition for the presidential chair at a future period. After he, Jefferson, entered on the duties of his station, the president was afflicted with a malady which, while it created dismay and alarm in the heart of every patriot, only excited the ambitious ardor of the secretary to remove out of his way every dangerous opponent. That melancholy circumstance suggested to him the probability of an approaching vacancy in the presidential chair, and that he would attract the public attention as the successor to it were the more popular Secretary of the Treasury out of the way." Perhaps Hamilton decided to suppress this recollection because it revealed his own presidential fantasies as well as Jefferson's. During Washington's illness, Hamilton and his minions, in a tremendous display of organizational skill, accosted congressmen and proselytized for assumption. The Treasury Secretary became a ubiquitous figure at Federal Hall, packing the gallery with supporters. Nobody was more offended than William McClay. In his journal, he castigated Hamilton as His Holiness, and on another occasion called him a damnable villain. Hamilton got off easy. John Adams reminded McClay of a monkey just put into breeches. On account of his whirling energy, Hamilton encountered enormous resistance from congressmen fearful of a strong executive branch. His activities brought to mind Robert Walpole, Britain's Chancellor of the Exchequer in the 1720s, who achieved such omnipotence that he was the first to acquire the title of Prime Minister. In Philadelphia, Benjamin Rush deplored Hamilton's high-pressure lobbying. "I question whether more dishonorable influence has ever been used by a British minister, bribery excepted, to carry a measure than has been used to carry the report of the secretary. This influence is not confined to nightly visits, promises, compromises, sacrifices, and threats in New York." Alexander Hamilton was trying through his assumption plan to preserve the Union, and yet nobody, for the moment, seemed to be widening its divisions more. If politics is preeminently the art of compromise, then Hamilton was in some ways poorly suited for his job. He wanted to be a statesman who led courageously, not a politician who made compromises. Instead of proceeding with small, piecemeal measures, he had presented a gigantic package of fiscal measures that he wanted accepted all at once. As the newspaper war against Hamilton heated up, Madison's backers scented victory. On April 8th, William McClay gloated over the gloom of Hamilton's adherents. "I never observed so drooping an aspect, so turbid and forlorn an appearance as overspread the partisans of the secretary in our house this afternoon. Rufus King looked like a boy that had been whipped." Maclay's exuberance was justified. On April 12, 1790, the House voted down Hamilton's assumption plan, 31-29, and 2 weeks later voted to discontinue all debate on the issue. By early June, it looked as if the assumption plan was heading for oblivion. So Hamilton began to search for a compromise that would salvage the linchpin of his economic program. The issue that he seized on was the divisive question of where the national capital should be located. At the Constitutional Convention, the delegates had decided to create a federal district, 10 miles square, in an unspecified location. This decision generated melodramatic speculation. Some people found the idea of a separate capital fraught with danger, fearing a privileged enclave. Governor George Clinton envisioned the 10-mile square as the scene of a presidential court, disfigured by royal trappings and marked by ambition with idleness, baseness with pride, the thirst of riches without labor, flattery, treason, perfidy, but above all, the perpetual ridicule of virtue. The capital's location had already led to intensive lobbying and intrigue. It was a monumental decision for contestants, since it would confer massive wealth, power, and population upon the winning state. More important, it would affect the style of the federal government, which was bound to soak up some of the political atmosphere of the surrounding region. In a large country with poor transportation, the voices of local citizens would resonate loudly in the ears of federal legislators. Complicating the debate was the expectation that there would first be a temporary capital, likely New York or Philadelphia, which would function as the makeshift seat of government while a permanent capital was readied. Notwithstanding his nationalist bent, Hamilton wanted New York to remain at least the temporary capital. In August 1788, he contacted his old mentor, Governor William Livingston of New Jersey, and expressed shock at reports that Livingston had capitulated to the snares of Pennsylvania and was leaning toward Philadelphia as temporary capital for the first Congress. The northeastern states feared the enhanced power that would accrue to Pennsylvania if it housed the temporary capital, which might then prove permanent. Before Livingston, Hamilton dangled a tantalizing deal. If he supported New York City as temporary capital, Hamilton would endorse Trenton, New Jersey as the long-term capital. Hamilton's desire to have the capital in New York intensified as Washington's inauguration neared. In February 1789, he made a spirited campaign speech for his friend John Lawrence, then running for Congress from New York City, and urged that as the residence of Congress would doubtless be esteemed a matter of some import to the city of New York, our representative should be a man well qualified in oratory to prove that this city is the best station for that honorable body. By January 17, 1790, with the uproar mounting over Hamilton's funding scheme, William McClay believed that Hamilton, emboldened by his burgeoning power, was determined to retain New York as the capital. I have attended in the minutest manner to the motions of Hamilton and the New Yorkers. Sincerity is not with them. They will never consent to part with Congress. In this tussle, New York was a controversial choice. It was becoming so associated with Hamilton that his enemies branded it Hamiltonopolis. For many Southerners, Jefferson in particular, New York City was an Anglophile bastion dominated by bankers and merchants who would contaminate the Republican experiment. These critics equated New York with the evils of London. Benjamin Rush, a Philadelphia booster, told Madison, "I am satisfied that the influence of our city will be against the Treasury Secretary's system of injustice and corruption. Philadelphia will be better ground to combat the system on than New York." The question of the capital served as a proxy for the question of whether America should assume an urban or agrarian character. Many Southerners believed that a northern capital would favor the mercantile, moneyed urban interests and discriminate against agrarian life. Jefferson's pastoral dream of a nation of small, independent farms had a powerful appeal to the American psyche, however much it differed from the slaveholding reality of the South. Jefferson, Madison, and Washington wanted a permanent capital on the Potomac, not far from Mount Vernon. For Jefferson, this would plant the nation's capital in a bucolic setting safe from abolitionist forces and the temptations of any overgrown commercial city. Madison and Henry Lee speculated in land on the Potomac, hoping to earn a windfall profit if the area was chosen for the capital. There were other political questions to consider. Should the capital be near the population or the geographic center of America? New York was scarcely equidistant from the northern and southern tips of the country. 16 of the 24 original senators came from south of the city, and this would present hardships for southern delegates who had to travel long distances. The choice of the capital was also seen as a referendum on America's future growth. For those who believed that the country would expand westward, a view especially prevalent in the southern states, whose western borders functioned as gateways to the frontier, a northeast capital would poorly serve America's future political landscape. All these simmering issues came to the surface during the ensuing debate. During the spring of 1790, quarrels over assumption and the national capital grew so vitriolic that it did not seem far-fetched that the Union might break up over the issues. The South increasingly fired at Hamilton the same vituperative rhetoric once directed at the British. In writing to Madison, Henry Lee stated that the battle to stop assumption brought back memories of the Revolution. "It seems to me that we Southern people must be slaves in effect or cut the Gordian knot at once." Jefferson long remembered the sour mood that hung like a miasma over New York that spring. "Congress met and adjourned from day to day without doing anything, the parties being too much out of temper to do business together." Of the two policies that Hamilton wished to promote, the federal assumption of state debt and the selection of New York as the capital, assumption was incomparably more important to him. It was the most effective and irrevocable way to yoke the states together into a permanent union. So when he saw that Madison possessed the votes to block assumption, Hamilton considered bargaining away New York as the capital in exchange for Southern support for assumption. As early as May 16th, glimmers of a deal emerged in a letter from Philip Schuyler to Stephen Van Rensselaer. "No motion has yet been brought forward to remove the seat of government, but we apprehend that, if the assumption is not carried, that the South Carolinians may, in order to obtain an object which is so important to them, negotiate with those who wish the removal." 9 days later, William McClay reported frantic negotiations. "The New Yorkers are now busy in the scheme of bargaining with the Virginians, offering the permanent seat on the Potomac for the temporary one in New York." On June 2, 1790, the House enacted Hamilton's funding bill without the assumption component. Hamilton knew he had to strike a deal quickly. Reluctant to surrender his reputation for uncompromising stands, he relied on deputies to make the conciliatory overtures. In the early Republic, it was difficult for politicians to engage in legislative maneuvering that later became standard practice, so Hamilton dispatched emissaries to sound out Robert Morris, the Pennsylvania senator and a leading proponent of Philadelphia as the capital. "I did not choose to trust them," Morris said, but wrote a note to Colonel Hamilton that I would be walking early in the morning on the battery, and if Colonel Hamilton had anything to propose to him, he might meet him there. To Morris's surprise, Hamilton was already at the rendezvous spot when he arrived. Hamilton's deal was simple. If Morris rounded up one vote in the Senate and five in the House for assumption, he would back Germantown or Trenton, both hard by Philadelphia, as the permanent capital. Hamilton had now tipped his hand as the master strategist behind the bargaining over the capital. Pennsylvania Congressman Peter Muhlenberg told Benjamin Rush, "It is now established beyond a doubt that the Secretary of the Treasury guides the movements of the Eastern Phalanx." What likely scuttled Hamilton's deal was that the Pennsylvania and Virginia delegations had already reached an understanding. Philadelphia would become the temporary capital and the Potomac site the permanent capital. End of Disc 13.